Shalom Chanukah to everyone. It's wonderful to see you on Chanukah as well. Today, in your honor, we are going to be doing the topic of free will. So,
no charge, huh?
It very much relates to what we actually discussed last week and the Parsha. So I'd like to start off with a question that someone asked after the shiur last week. I don't remember who it was. I think you asked, but after the shiur, we're going to begin with that question, and that will lead us to our discussion. And the question was as follows. Last week, essentially, we laid out the theory, as expressed by the Abarbanel, Rav Sadia Gaon, and others, that even though a person has free will, whether or not they're going to do something, let's say a murderer, if Reuven kills Shimon, Reuven had free will, it was his free choice to kill Shimon. At the same time, Shimon would not die if God had not decreed that they would die. These two things, which are seemingly contradictory, exist simultaneously. How is it possible? The basic theory that we saw was that it is possible because Shimon could die in many ways. So Shimon would not die if God hadn't decreed that Shimon should die. But at the same time, his death could take place through Reuven. He could get hit by a car. He could get struck by lightning. All sorts of possible ways. God has many ways, harbe shluchim lamakom, to carry out his decree. And thus, Reuven is held responsible for Shimon's death, even though Shimon's death was inevitable. That was the primary theory, though we considered others, but the primary theory that we saw last week. Now, this plays itself out in terms of the story of Yosef that we read about in these parshios. On the one hand, the brothers are held responsible for Yosef's sale. They acted inappropriately when they sold Yosef, and they accept this. In this week's parsha, we read about how Yehuda says to the brothers that we are responsible for this. We sinned when we sold him. This is happening to us because of our evil deeds. And yet, at the same time, Yosef tells them, when he finally reveals himself to them in next week's parsha, Yosef says, Lo atem shalachtem osihena ki im halokim. It was not you who sent me here, but God. Meaning to say that my enslavement was preordained by God, and you're not responsible. And we asked, how are both of these true? And the answer is, they're both true. God had a plan for Yosef to come to Egypt, whether it's in order to support the Jews during the famine, or, as we saw last week, part of the bigger plan of the Bris Bein HaBasharim, the enslavement and the redemption. That could have happened in any number of ways, and it happened to come about through his being sold into slavery, which was the result of the free choice of the brothers. So the question then is, what is going on when Yosef tells his brothers, don't worry, because it was God who sent me down, not here, not you? Well, what does that mean? Don't worry. It was your free choice. He has no right to say that. That was the question that was posed after the shiur was over. So I'd like to begin with that, because that brings us very nicely into our topic. The answer to that, I believe, is quite simple, and I once heard a similar approach from Rabbi Meir Tursky. The answer is that when it comes to it all is a question of perspective. When something bad happens to me, and that something bad was the result of the free choice of some other character, I get mugged, for example. So it is true that, if we take this thesis, that if I got mugged, it was because God had ordained that I be mugged. But at the same time, it would not have happened had the mugger not made that free choice. That being the case, Yosef is telling them as follows. From my perspective, I am not angry at you. Don't worry. Yosef was trying to assuage them. Yosef was trying to tell them, I'm not upset at you. Why is that? I'm not upset at you because from my perspective, this happened because God wanted it to happen. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do tshuva. That doesn't mean that you didn't do something wrong. It just means I am not upset at you. The Sefer HaChinuch says a very similar idea when he discusses the Torah's prohibition against nekama, the prohibition against revenge. The Chinuch says that you shouldn't take revenge because if this happened to you, it was supposed to happen to you, even though at the same time, their choice was made freely. So, you had a question.
Yeah. I thought there's a difference between Yosef, which is a special case, and a plain old guy. Plain old Reuven kills Shimon. I'm not sure why we're saying decree. It's not beforehand God said he has to die. Now that he's doing it, God says, I won't stop him. Is that,
so that
different
is
from decree ahead
yes,
of time?
Yes, that's a very different approach. There are those who do take that approach. Last week we mentioned the Or HaChaim, the Zohar, and the like, who essentially take your approach. And they assume, no, it is possible that if Reuven decides to kill Shimon, that free choice, he's able to kill Shimon, even though Shimon, it was not decreed that Shimon should die. And this relates to a broader question as well, which is the different perspectives on divine providence. There are those who take a more expansionist view of divine providence. Everything that happens, happens because it was divinely decreed, except for perhaps it matters pertaining to free will. There are those who take a more minimalist approach to providence, and we could certainly spend a shiur discussing that question. But now, with that in mind, I'd like to turn to our current topic, which is that of free will. The approach that we saw last week presumes that there is free will. The approach assumes that if the brothers sold Yosef, they did so freely. They could have chosen not to do so, and the like. So, what is the basis of this assumption of free will? Is it something that's taken for granted? Can we prove it? How do we know it? Are there those that question it? Before beginning, I would like to just note that it's fascinating that free will is perhaps the doctrine, if we assume it is a central doctrine to Jewish belief, which I believe it is, that has been most challenged over the years. There have been, from ancient times to modern times, those who have questioned and challenged free will. In the ancient world, there were those who felt that fate determines everything, whether it's mazalos, the constellations, or whether it's destiny or divine decree. There are those who challenged free will because it seems to contradict the notion of foreknowledge, divine foreknowledge. How is it possible that God could know in advance what I'm going to choose and still at the same time I have freedom whether or not to choose it? To the modern world, whether there are those who question and challenge and reject free will based on modern psychology, the idea that, to distill it into one sentence, a person's decisions are entirely predetermined based on their nature and their nurture. What's more prominent, whether it's the genes or whether it's their environment, but one way or the other, it's the combination of the two that determines a person's choices. In the study of neuroscience, the theory that basically all decisions take place in the brain, we could go ahead and figure out and chart this biologically and the like, and therefore there is no room for free will. And therefore, again, from ancient times to modern times, this question, this notion has been something that was challenged. In fact, if you look in Josephus writes that the three major groups of Jews that lived in at his time debated this very issue, the issue of free will. The Essenes, those are most famous to us from the Dead Sea Scrolls, essentially believed that fate determined everything. The Tzedukim believed that both fate and divine intervention are incorrect, and everything was determined by free will. And the Purushim, the Pharisees, what became Rabbinic Judaism, what became our Judaism, is maintained very, very strongly that both things exist simultaneously. There is such a thing as divine intervention of providence, but there's also freedom. So this debate was the central debate towards the end of the Second Temple period, and it's a debate that rages until today. So obviously we're not going to address everything. There were those traditional Jewish thinkers who questioned some elements of free will. The most famous example of that is Chasdai Kreskes, Perhaps we'll have a chance to allude to his position. But we're going to start today, after we are questioned, we're going to start from the beginning. We're going to start from Psukim. We'll work our way through Chazal and at least the medieval theories. And specifically, I hope to briefly address the major issue of the contradiction between foreknowledge, divine foreknowledge, and free will. Yes?
Removing this last point that needs further analysis and amplification, if mm-hmm. right. But what confuses me a little bit is traditional religious Judaism, to me, has to say this free will mm-hmm. simply because it's a derivative of one or two other basic assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
If you say that there is a God in the world mm-hmm. who's according to the concept of religious Judaism, it's a God
mm-hmm.
who is just,
mm-hmm.
righteous, and also is involved with reward and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make those two statements and say there's no free will because there's no way to do just reward and punishment. So taking it out of any other realm,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, to me, the
okay.
end of the story.
So absolutely correct. And that is why the vast, vast majority of thinkers accept the notion that there's free will, when I mean Jewish thinkers, traditional Jewish thinkers, and they all make the point that you said, which is that to deny free will is to deny justice, divine justice. Absolutely. So, according to your analysis, this should be a short shear.
From a Jewish standpoint. You still have the philosophical issue in its
right.
own right,
mm-hmm.
whether foreknowledge
mm-hmm.
precludes free will
right.
or not.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
is legitimate.
Okay.
A side issue. Rana talks about in Hichlus Tshuva.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not in the 13 Ikarim.
Yes.
Does that mean he doesn't consider it to be an Ikar?
Okay, it's a good question. Why doesn't those that have asked that question, why doesn't he, why isn't it listed in the Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna? That relates to a broader question, which again, I'd love to have a shir on. What were the Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna meant to do? The Rambam clearly thinks that it is a central belief, a belief that all of Judaism is predicated upon. And if so, the question is, why isn't it a central belief in terms of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna? And there are different approaches taken to answering that question. Some offer a philosophical or historical answers, others in terms of what Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna are meant to do. And it's beyond the scope of tonight's year, but it's something definitely to keep in mind. A very good question. Okay, let's start with the Torah. On source one, the right column, top source, the Torah says in Sefer Dvarim, Ha'idosi b'chem hayom es ha'shamayim v'es ha'aretz es ha'chayim v'es ha'maves ha'chayim v'ha'maves nasati lefanacha bracha v'aklala uv'acharta b'chayim l'man tichya ata v'zaracha. God says that I've placed before you good and evil, life and death, and you shall choose life so that you and your descendants shall live. God here unequivocally tells us that I've given you the choice. I've given you the choice of life and death, good and evil, and I'm urging you, please choose life. Clearly implied here is the notion of free will. There are many other psukim to this effect. One other important pasuk to note is the pasuk in Eicha. Mipi elyon lo seitzei haraos vehatov. That from God does not emanate the good and bad, meaning to say good and bad emanates from our free choices. It is our choice. It is not decreed from upon high. And in fact, these psukim lead to the admonition for tshuva. Because it is our choices, therefore we must repent. It is not surprising then that the Rambam discusses Hilchos Tshuva discusses the topic of free will in Hilchos Tshuva. The next source that I was going to see with you is from Emunos Videos, or Sad Yagon. I think we'll skip it for now. Perhaps we'll refer back to it shortly. And we'll turn straight away to the Rambam. Again, of course, we're skipping a lot here. I should note though, that the primary source in Chazal for this issue is the Gemara that appears in a number of places, in Nida and Ksubos, which says that Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim. What that means is that everything is in God's hands except for Yerushamayim. Yerushamayim, the Rambam writes in a tshuva, means, broadly defined, everything that relates to free will. So that God may control all sorts of things. Again, the extent of providence is a separate debate, but except for Yerushamayim. So Chazal are telling us that whether I am a good person or a bad person, whether I choose to do right or choose to do wrong, is not in God's hands. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be in God's hands, but that God limits himself so as to allow free will. This relates to whether it's the mystical notion of Tzimtzum or the way the philosophers, like the Rambam, present it. Free will, our ability to freely choose, is something that God allows for, and in a certain sense implies a form of self-limitation, and we're going to return to that topic shortly.
Can you say the last sentence again? I can digest it better.
The concept of free will is predicated on the fact that God, in a certain sense, limits himself so as to allow us to have free will.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay. Isn't that, I thought it's positive. If God can do anything, he can also sit back and not do something. That's also doing, that's also being a king.
For now, we'll accept that. So let's begin with the Rambam. The Rambam first addresses this topic in Shmoneh Prakim, which is his introduction to Pirkei Avos, on the left column on the first page. E efshar shivaled ha'adam b'tava ba'al ma'aleh o ba'al chisaron. Kemo shi efshar shivaled b'tava ba'al melacha me'amlachot. A person is not born with a teva, either a positive or a negative teva, just like a person is not born being a carpenter or a musician or the like. Aval, efshar shivaled b'teva muchan l'ma'ala o l'chisaron. B'hayot p'ulot ha'adam, p'ulot ha'achad, yoter kalot alav mi'pulot ha'acher. But that doesn't mean to say that we are not born with a certain predilection. Meaning to say, just like certain people will be born with the ability to learn mathematics or music much more quickly and much more easily than other people, a musical prodigy does not mean that they can play piano when they're 2 years old, just sit down, but it means that they will very, very quickly learn how to do it. What would take a normal person years, they might figure out in a matter of hours or months. So he's saying that nobody's born with a teva ma'ala o chisaron, but people are born with natural predilections. Kigon, sheye etze mocho zach, viakel alav lilmod, aval im yunach b'mazgo ze mibli lilmod, v'lo ye'orer kochotav, yishaer b'li safek sachal. A person might have the ability to become very intelligent. However, if they are never exposed to wisdom, then it will be left unfulfilled. A person might be born with the ability to be a musical prodigy, but if they're born into a house where there's no musical instruments and they're never exposed to music, then that natural
propensity
will never be fulfilled. And that's what the Rambam's writing. This is true with respect to all things. So, skipping now to the next set of underlined this Gemara that we mentioned, that everything is in God's hands except for Yerushamayim, hu gamkein emes, ki mitzvos ha-Torah v'azharoseha, hein bepu'ulos, asher la'adam bahen b'chira la'asosan olo. The mitzvos of the Torah all relate to matters that are dependent upon a person's free will. Uma shamru akol bidei shamayim, rotza lomar, hanyanim hativiim, she'en l'adam b'chira bahem. When we say everything is in God's hands, that means to say natural things that a person does not have freedom about. Kigon shaya aroch o katzar. Whether a person is going to be tall or short, for the most part, is not in their hands. Now, course, environmental factors are a big factor.
Subject to that decision.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't choose whether I'm going to be tall or short. More or less, my height is largely affected by my genes, my environment. It's not related to choices that I made. And skipping down again to the bolded section, Hadvarim ha'elu lo amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu el ish yadua ad sheyomar shenigzar alav v'nishar kol ish v'ish bevchirato v'chol mitzri haya yachol shelo yechasem yechasmem ilu haya rotzeh. Here the Rambam relates to the point we said last week. Even when we find in the Torah certain predictions, like the servitude in Egypt, that does not take away freedom. Rather, each individual Egyptian had the choice whether or not they were going to persecute the Jews or enslave or murder the Jews. Now, he then has to deal with the case, which is the next bolded section, the topic which we're not going to talk about tonight, just for lack of time. What about the cases in the Torah, like the hardening of Paro's heart or the like, where God seems to state explicitly that he removed somebody's free will? That's a topic that we'll deal with separately, but the Rambam does acknowledge that in that case there are times when freedom is limited. Okay, now, then in the top right he deals with the issue of foreknowledge, but we'll see that in the Mishnah Torah. I started off with this introduction to the Rambam from the Shmona Prakim, because if you don't begin the Mishnah Torah with this introduction, you will most likely, or I should say, I misunderstood the Mishnah Torah until I saw what he said here in Shmona Prakim. So it's very important to recognize, especially to study the Rambam, both in his chronological order, but also in terms of knowing this as an introduction. So now we'll begin the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, and we'll conclude with the Rambam in the Morah Nevuchim. The Mishnah Torah, page 2, right column, Hilchos Tshuva, Perkei Halacha Aleph. He begins, Rishus l'chol adam nesuna, im ratza l'hatos atzmo l'derech tova, v'lios tzadik ha'rishus biyado. A person is given freedom if he wishes to turn himself to the good path and be righteous. He has that in his power. Likewise, the reverse, if he chooses to be a rasha, that too is in his power. Who shakasuv b'torah, hein ha'adam haya ke'achad mimenu ladas tovara. I think it's fascinating that he chooses this verse as his first verse to quote. I would have expected him to open up with the verse that we cited at the beginning, Uvacharta b'chayim. The Rambam does quote that later. He begins with this. This, of course, is the pasuk that is from the beginning of the book of Bereishis, and it relates to the sin, the Eitz Hadas Tovara, the sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The Rambam actually over here understands Ladas Tovara to mean that he could choose whether or not to do good or evil. The interpretation that he presumes here is actually different than the one that he gives in the guide when he explains this. In the beginning of the guide, he discusses this point. And again, another time, I'd love to give a shiur on what those chapters mean, but not for now. I'd just like to make a minor point here, which I think is important. The Rambam, perhaps, uses this pasuk because it offers a very interesting insight about the nature of freedom. The Torah uses the words ladat, according to the Rambam, to refer to a person's ability to choose good and evil. So, hein haya ha'adam ke'achad mimenu ladat tovara, kilomar, this means to say, hein min zeh shel adam haya yachid ba'olam. This creation of humans, or man, is unique in the world, meaning to say there is no other creation, whether it's animals or angels, that has free will. Vein min sheni domelo bezeh, ha'inyan shiyehu me'atzmo bida'ato uvemachshavto. That's why the Torah uses the word ladat. So that man, with his knowledge and understanding, is yodea tovara, knows good and evil, ve'oseh kol mashu chafetz, and then is able to do it. The Rambam here notes that there are really two components to free will, which the Torah presumes. Number one is the ability to determine what's right or wrong, la'da'at tov v'ra, yodeya hatov v'hara. In other words, if a person has freedom to choose what to do, but he's not able to ascertain or determine what is right or what is wrong, then that freedom is not meaningful in our context. It would still be, to use your analysis, inappropriate to punish such a person. So freedom, or meaningful free will, by definition, demands two things. Number one, that he is able to yodeya hatov v'ara, to determine that which is right and wrong. Now, how does he know? Partially based on revelation, but partially based on his intellect. The Rambam uses the word bida'ato uvimachshavto, meaning to say a human being on his own is able to determine right from wrong. This is a central theme that the Rambam has in many of his writings. Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim that human beings are held accountable for the decisions that they make, even in the absence of revelation. This relates to the concept of natural law and is again a fascinating topic in its own right, one that I'd like to return to on another time. But that is point one. So point one in terms of freedom is that humans are able to know what's right and wrong. And then part B is the oseh kol ma shehu chafetz. And then they are able to do what they wish. So they're able to determine what's right or wrong and then carry that out. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you could succeed in carrying it out. Meaning to say, Reuven can decide that he's going to kill Shimon. So he's able to determine that it's wrong, and he's able to carry it out. Now, he may or may not succeed in killing Shimon. His gun might jam. He might get into a car accident on the way over to Shimon's house. There are all sorts of impediments that certainly are beyond his freedom. However, he at the very least has the ability to choose to attempt to carry out his decision. Whether or not he succeeds perhaps goes back to the issue of providence. Yes?
Does that mean there's an innate ability, an innate knowledge?
Yes.
That knows, as opposed to upbringing?
Upbringing is a role, has a role, certainly. And the extent to which a person has an ability to know right from wrong will certainly vary from person to person. It will vary depend on your age. A 6-year-old's ability to figure out what's right or wrong is different than a 13-year-old's, which is different than a 20-year-old's, different than a 40-year-old. Hopefully we develop. Depends on your education, it depends on your upbringing and the like. So there's no doubt, as we saw from the Rambam himself, that nature, one's natural predilection, has a very important role here. The Rambam is not denying that. Moreover, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that a person's environment plays a huge role over the choices that they make. In fact, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that because environmental considerations are so powerful, if a person finds themselves in a pernicious environment, they must leave. And he goes so far as to say that if there's nowhere else where you could go, better to move to a desert, because if you're in a certain environment, it's almost impossible not to be influenced by that environment.
And we had the Avos put themselves into this position.
Absolutely. And so the Rambam here is not saying that everything is free. And that's the point that we're gonna get to. But to some degree, the Rambam writes, it's absolutely true that human beings on their own are capable of determining what's right and what's wrong. Of course, we have a Torah, and that's something that helps us. The Torah is given to us, among other things, because we can't always determine that which is right and that which is wrong about every single question. So the Torah is meant to help us, but there is some type of basic and innate ability, which will, as we say, vary from person to person, concerning the ability to determine what's right and what's wrong. Yes?
So I understand that for Jews, and I I understand, let's assume you didn't have some Shevet Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, but what do you say about somebody who grew up in a society of Eved Menachai, or someone who grew up in a society without din, or somebody who grew up on a tobacco plantation and there were slaves, or...
Sure.
Would the Rambam say that that person doesn't have the ability to have schar because they'll always be making the wrong choices?
It's a very good question. And
could you take the next statement that you have bolded, because that's going to you can
okay.
further
so,
sharpen.
So we'll read the next statement and we'll get to that. I just want to point out an interesting point here, and then we'll go on. The Rambam here alludes to a point that's very important to note as well, which is he relates freedom to man's intellect and also his soul. The Tselem Elokim relates to their ability to freely choose. One of the responses, and again, this is something we could develop, but I think one of the correct responses to the charge based on modern neuroscience concerning the lack of ability of free will really relates to an issue of basic definitions of who we are. The question, as it's frequently posed, is if all we are our bodies, our brains, and the like, then what room is there for free will? Our choices are simply made on a cellular level based on the reactions of neurons and the like. And the basis of free will, the Rambam alludes to here and develops in the Mora, as well as other sources, is in our soul. Now, we shouldn't expect to be able to find the soul using a CAT scan or brain imagery or the like, because it's not a physical thing. And therefore, if your conclusion that there's no free will is based on the fact that all we can see in a brain scan is a brain, the brain is just a bunch of cells, and what room is there for freedom except for perhaps on a minute level with respect to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, so then there's no room for free will, well then, I could respond that you're right, the freedom emerges from something non-physical within us, and that is the soul. That's a point that I think the Rambam's alluding to here. Let's read Halacha Beis, however, and then we will go back to your question. Okay. Ve'en mishi akev biado melasos hatov o hara. There's nobody inhibiting a person from doing that which is right or wrong. V'kevan shekein, therefore, who, v'kevan shekein, who pen yishlach yado, the conclusion of the pasuk, lest he there actually take the etzachayim. Al yavor b'machshav techa, davar zesh omim tipshe umot ha'olam v'rov golmei Yisrael, shakadosh baruch hu gozer al adam mitchilat b'riato liot tzadiko rasha. Do not entertain the possibility, what many people say, both Jews and non-Jews, that God decrees upon a person whether to be righteous or not righteous. Ein adavar kein, this is not so. Ela kol adam ra'ui lihios tzadik kemosh rabbeinu o rasha ki ravam. Every person has the ability to be righteous like Moshe or wicked like Yeravam. Now, this is fascinating. One objection that people raise is, how could a person be like Moshe? Isn't it a pasuk in the Torah, lo kam b'Yisrael k'Moshe od? The answer to that question is relatively simple. What is that pasuk talking about? Prophecy. And it's true. There will never be a prophet like Moshe. The level of prophecy that a person reaches is not something in their free will. Rambam did not claim that everybody could have the free choice whether to be a Navi or not a Navi, or how great of a Navi. And thus, God guarantees that there will never be a prophet like Moshe. Why that's important is another question, a very interesting one. But the Rambam writes that everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe, or a rasha like Yeravam. It's fascinating that he chooses Yeravam also.
As
the foil, yeah. Right? But what's fascinating is that you could have picked a bigger rasha. Why not Achav, right? So I think that relates to the idea Yeravam stood at a fork in history that could have gone in two very different ways, and his choice is made it go in one way and not the other, as
so
did Moshe.
So your Rebbe started off as a learned person.
That too, as well. Yeah.
It's called Chodei Machti as a Rabbi.
That too. Okay. Anyhow.
So you understand this?
So one second. Now, well, that's the question. Let's go there in a second. Then he says some interesting things. O Chacham O Sachel O Rachman O Achzari. He could choose to be. Now, literally, this sounds like wise or foolish. We have to obviously read this statement in light of what we saw. He said in Pirkei Avos, which is that certain people have a natural predilection in terms of acquisition of knowledge and the like. So he doesn't mean that I can be at, you know, anybody could be as brilliant as Einstein, but what he means to say is to choose the path of Chachma, or the path of Sichlus, of wisdom or foolishness, or Rachman or Achzari, kind or cruel or the like. Now, let's go back to your question and your question. So, there are different ways to read this Rambam. The first thing I would like you to keep in mind is the following, and this relates to a great debate within the Rambam. It's a debate that has raged for hundreds of years in terms of what is the Rambam's position. You mentioned reward specifically and the like. A critical source here, and again, this is perhaps, again, a unit in its own right, but a critical source here is the Rambam's theory, which he expresses in many places in Pirush HaMishnayos, Mor HaNevuchim, Mishneh Torah. One place where it's most clear is in the second chapter of Hilchos Mamrim in the Mishneh Torah, the concept of Tinok Shenishba. The Rambam there writes that if you have a person who rejects fundamental beliefs of Judaism, such a person has no chelik in Olam Haba, is excluded from the Jewish people. This is his theory in terms of Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah. But what about if this is a conclusion that they made basically because they were raised in an environment that conclusion was the foregone conclusion? They were never presented with the alternative. For example, someone who rejects the notion of Chazal, Torah Shebaal Peh, and the like. The belief in Torah Shebaal Peh is one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah. So what about if someone is born a Karaite or a Tzeduki, and they're not Tzadok, they're not even that generation, they were born and they were brought up this way. Are they held? Right, exactly. Are they held responsible for their beliefs? After all, they reject one of the 13 principles of the faith. They reject the belief in Torah Shebaal Peh. The Rambam says absolutely not. The Rambam says they are onus. They're not held accountable for their beliefs. They will not be punished for their wrongful beliefs. They are onus. Just like we have a principle in matters of law called onus rachmana patre. God forgives someone. You're not punished for an action that you did through coercion. And that's even true, by the way, if it's a situation that you should have chosen otherwise. For example, the halacha is that avodah zarah is yarg vel yavor. A person must give their life before doing idolatry. But at the same time, if somebody goes ahead and sticks a gun to their head and says, I want you to bow to this idol, and they don't offer their life, they're not held accountable. They're not chayiv misa for that act because it was done through coercion. Something that was done without a person's free choice is never punished. Ones rachmana patre. The Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim, as well as others, says that's not just true with respect to wrongful actions and crimes, but it's also true with respect to mistakes and mistaken beliefs. And therefore, a person is not held accountable for their rejection of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah if it was because they were brought up with this. The Rambam parallels this to the concept in the Talmud of Tinok Shenishba Lebein Homos. Tinok Shenishba Lebein Homos means that if someone was born or taken captive as a young child, and as such was never educated Jewishly, he was never taught about what Shabbos is. So the Talmud treats that very differently from a person who was brought up Jewishly and educated. And the Rambam expands that position. He says, well, who is a heretic? Perhaps the original Karaites, the original Tzedukim, the ones who knew better and rejected. But the second, third, fourth, fifth generations, they are not held accountable. And this, of course, as you pointed out, relates to the modern world. Already Rav Ettlinger and the Chazon Ish expanded this and the like, assume that none of the traditional terminologies with respect to sinners apply to non-observant Jews nowadays, at least those that were born into non-observance, because they were never educated otherwise. We couldn't consider them, hold them accountable for not being Shomer Shabbos, because they were never taught what it means to be Shomer Shabbos. So the Rambam clearly then tells us that a person is not held accountable for those types of beliefs. Now, perhaps we'll distinguish between different types of beliefs, but ultimately the Rambam maintains that Ones Rachmana Patre applies to Emunos Videos as well. I believe that this is a aspect of the Rambam that's widely misunderstood, especially concerning his approaches to the Yud Gimel Ikar Emunah. The standard academic approach is that the Rambam was a hardliner, and simply if you don't, Olam Haba is based entirely on the acquired intellect, such that if a person has not reached that level of intellectual sophistication, Olam Haba is definitionally impossible. I believe that notion is contradicted from the concept of Tinok Shenishba and could be proven from statements within the Mor Nevuchim itself. But that's a bigger conversation for another time. Now, I'd like to just conclude tonight's discussion, and this could be the beginning of a discussion. We could certainly go back to this topic in terms of the Rambam statement over here. And we'll skip another 1,000 years or 800 years to an idea which was most clearly articulated by Rabbi Dessler. However, it's one that has its roots in Rishonim. It's an idea that at first glance seems to be the opposite of the Rambam, but I actually believe, and again, perhaps if we had time, I'm not saying the Rambam and Rav Dessler are the same, but they're not as far apart as would seem at first. And Rav Dessler develops what he calls the notion of a Nekudas HaBechira. Nekudas HaBechira means literally the point of freedom. And his basic theory is that a person does not have practical freedom about many of the choices that they make in life. There is what we could call theoretical free will and actual or meaningful or practical free will. Practically, both for good and for bad, I do not consider all sorts of options. I don't consider murder. It's not something that I struggle with. And I don't consider all sorts of great acts of piety. Those are beyond my Nekudas HaBechira. A person struggles within a relatively narrow area in terms of their freedom. That area, at first, is very much determined perhaps by their nature and their nurture, where they're born into, and the like. But also changes significantly throughout their life based on the choices that they freely make. So, to take a very benign example, if I go ahead and right now I struggle with being on time to Shacharis. So I go ahead and I wake up, I set my alarm, and I struggle, do I hit snooze or not? If I hit snooze, I'm going to be 5 minutes late. And if I get up, I'm going to be on time. If I go ahead and make high-level choices, and for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I come on time, it will almost become second nature. I won't even consider snooze. I might struggle with something else. Maybe do I come just on time, or do I come 5 minutes early so that I could prepare for davening and pray in a much more meaningful way because I'm not just rushing? That will be my struggle. On the contrary, if I go ahead and I hit snooze for a week, then hitting snooze will almost become my second nature, and my struggle is going to be, am I 5 minutes late or 10 minutes late? And those are really what I struggle with. And that changes throughout my life. And that changes, those changes are going to determine how much a person accomplishes. So going back to the Rambam's idea that everybody could be a tzaddik like Moshe or a rasha like Yeravam, the way Rav Dessler interprets that is as follows. Everybody could be as righteous as Moshe insofar as Moshe fulfilled his potential. The greatness of Moshe was that he became as great as he possibly could become. Ah, we always get a hint. It's like before the opera starts. And the greatness, that was the greatness of Moshe. Anybody could achieve their potential, meaning to say, anyone, thank you. Going back to your question, anyone could become as great as they possibly could become, and anyone could end up very, very far from their potential. Greatness is marked not by objective accomplishments, but rather by the extent to which a person fulfills their potential. That is ultimately what determines greatness, and accordingly, we could absolutely say Rav Dessler says everyone could be as great as Moshe, and everyone could be as wicked as Yeravam. What as great as Moshe means for one person, for the slave or whoever it is very different than what it means for somebody else. But they both have that same potential of being as great as they possibly can, and that's the way he does it. So, as I said, this is perhaps an introduction to a bigger conversation, and throughout the course of the year, we'll come back to these questions again and again, because they touch on almost everything. Have a Freilich and Chanukah to one and all, and I hope to see you next week.
Are you going to Maroc?